You've expanded your questions on beyond my attention span, and I had an answer to the first and lost the next two. I think it's interesting that you should bring it up, that I feel that wheelchair ambulation, additional canes and crutches, appropriate bracing is appropriate management. And some of the people that I saw in my clinic were managed in that fashion. Some are managed on exercise. The clinic protocol, and time didn't permit me to talk about that, are people in whom there's an agreed upon goal, a functional goal, of an increased quadricep strength, an increased triceps or biceps, something we can measure on the Cybex, and an agreed upon muscle that had been functioning, that had been lost. So those are people that we're looking at from the standpoint of a concept of a lost function from muscle learning or under training. So when I'm talking about one group that I'm looking at from a clinical research standpoint, albeit a difficult one because of the nature of compliance with exercise. But I don't look upon wheelchairs and ambulatory aids as a step backwards. I look upon it as probably a thing that would have been wise to begin with. I'm surprised how many people resist the idea of using a cane when they walk and tumble through life without one and say that they'd be embarrassed to use an aid. Of course, it's easy for me to say.
That's it.
Oh, very much so. Yes. And and we can almost use any technique, any form of monkey business, electrical stimulation or Kenny technique or facilitation or a powder board or pool. And once I started thinking about it, I even could make my peroneal muscles on my left leg start to contract again, and I can make my quadriceps twitch. But I did that in bed last night, wondering about muscle relearning. It wasn't really fasciculations, although I didn't test it. So.
I still love Seattle. I'd like to remind folks of the relationship between endurance levels or fatigue and maximum strength. That's well known already in muscles from a lot of data that's available, that 10 to 15% of maximum strength is the strength level at which you can endure essentially indefinitely. So through disuse or through inactivity, if you lose maximum strength, you will also lose the level at which you can endure indefinitely and hence get into fatigue. So strengthening programs on people who have been relatively inactive will help their endurance level as well. And the second comment I'd like to make is when we're doing our little clinics here and we're reporting on all these symptomatologies, I would like to suggest that from a real data point of view, that once you have as a control group, the peers are so-called normal equivalents of the polio patients, because a lot of the symptomatology of pain and weakness, I think, general population has.
That again, Walter, if I had in my written report, which you'll, I'm sure, read someday with great interest, has that statement in it that I feel that... what's that? You don't have an advanced copy? Yeah, I would hope so. Well, I'll send you mine signed. I feel that that's true. I agree with you. And one of our groups that we must look at is normal subjects. In fact, in a thing that I wrote for our people that we were surveying, I wrote a document that summarized our first two conferences, and I said that we really need to find out what the incidence of easy fatigability, unexplained pain syndromes, and even diminished muscle strength.
Thank you very much, Dr. Owen. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Mylon Knapp, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, who will share with us some of his thoughts about polio from a historical perspective and what it looks like currently in Minnesota. Dr. Knapp?
If I
started to share my thoughts about polio, we last till next week. So I'm not going to do that. My part in the program is that Dick and I got talking about not only this meeting, but the late effects that have been talked about all of the time we've been here. And one thing that I felt was lacking is the incidence of this. Everybody's been reporting problems, but always in people who have problems. And so we're getting the people who have the effects of polio without knowing, you know, how many of them there are. So I checked in Minnesota. Our last major epidemic was in 1952. And three places that treat polio in the Minneapolis area are Kenney Institute and Sheltering Arms and the university. And I have found that it is possible to find the names of all of these people. And the numbers are this, that at Sister Kenney, this is from July 1st, 1952 to July 1st, 1953, which would be essentially that epidemic year. At Kenney, there were 1,174 patients. Now, these were primarily acute patients. In fact, I think most of those, almost all of them, would be acute. At Sheltering Arms, there were 507, and at the university, 170. So I have already got the names of all the ones from the university. That was the easiest. And am going at the Kenney ones. The Sheltering Arms ones are going to be a little harder because Sheltering Arms was a hospital only because of polio and is now defunct. So, but I think I can get, in fact, I've been assured that I can get those. And so I'd like to see how many of the patients we have actually have problems. Because I think that's a thing that we do need to know. I don't have any figures to give you. But I hope in a year or two to have those figures. And then if this turns out to be practical, we may try to go back through the years. Our first big epidemic in Minnesota was in 1946. And that's all I have to say.
Dr. Knapp? Would you care to entertain a question or two?
Okay.
Is there somebody in the audience who has a question for Dr. Knapp? Or a comment? Joe?
It only has to do with the next step. Joe Crawford from Manitoba. Basically, the list of names as they were in 52 may be about 40% traceable in terms of your experience, but or maybe as high as 55, but young women who had polio, whose names changed due to marriage, the tracing outside of states when you don't have a situation like Olmsted County or like we had to a lesser extent in Manitoba. We essentially spent about 9 months tracing those names that have changed via marriage records, death records, this kind of thing. So there's one step in between where you are now and doing the possibility of prevalence follow-up kind of thing. It's an interesting process, but in a mobile population, like some of the centers that you've been dealing with, where there are wide regional effects or even national effects, you may run into the same kinds of things that the Warm Springs Center did, of people coming from all over, and addresses we found over a 30-year period changed among cosmopolitan groups as many as 5 to 6 times. So you've got to use either an informal network approach of finding them, or you've got to go to other kinds of registries.
I realize that, and I know it's going to be a long, big, hard job. I just hope we can get enough of them to make it worthwhile.
B- Before we go on to the next speaker, Dr. Perry did have one comment she wanted to make to Dr. Owen's presentation.
Now, the question I wanted to ask is what his criteria were to differentiate overuse from underuse, and when he used protection and when he used exercise.
Where'd he go?
Well, I'm awfully glad that I had a chance to answer that question, because I was afraid I wouldn't. I protect a weak muscle that's under stress when it's being used in function, in walking, in arm activities, and I use exercise as exercise in those instances. The exercise is not the use of the part for function, but the exercise is exercise for exercise sake. And in those people that we're studying, that's the that's one of the outgrowths that I hope to, I mean, one of the outgrowths is the question of what is muscle learning and muscle unlearning and detraining.
I'm Robert Schlenz from Los Angeles, and I have a question for Dr. Owen. You spoke about a patient that you said you had improved from a grade 2 to a grade 4 plus on quadriceps strength. I'd like you to tell us specifically how you did this, what the patient's functions or activities of daily living were, whether they were restricted, how they were brought into this, and just go into complete detail about how you handled this case.
This man was an engineer at the Honeywell company. I find that engineers and lawyers are the best exercisers. They tend to be more meticulous than doctors and other artists and poets. This man had a functioning quadriceps, had at one time lifted 11 pounds with his quadriceps, and he'd known that. He was fishing off the coast of Wisconsin, overstrained his quadriceps muscle, and lost function sufficiently so that he went from walking without a cane to walking with a cane. He continued to work, going back and forth, climbing stairs as always, but he came in with a grade 2 plus quadriceps, 2 plus out of 5, I think is the way we're talking about things here. We started him on a resistive exercise program in which he lifted weights a la the Ruben Feldman technique, and first in gravity-eliminated postures, side-lying, using a powder board. And in conjunction with that, he did that 3 days a week, and twice a week he did cardiopulmonary conditioning of an aerobic type in a swimming pool. So I mixed aerobic conditioning with a progressive resistive exercise program. He built up to 11 pounds. I told him to stop exercising except for once a week lifting an 11-pound weight. So that's how we did it. What's that? Yes. He strained his muscle pulling a boat in, and he felt he had a specific time and event. I think I would have cautioned him, I agree, but yes? Oh, the one point that I wanted to make, because we have some excellent neuropathologists and neurophysiologists and psychophysiologists here, is that one of my concepts is that maybe the sprouted or the sick anterior horn cell, whichever it is, suffers more from anoxia than, or from hypoxia than the well anterior horn cell. And so I wondered if this might be a cause of the phenomenon of overwork, or the phenomenon of fatigue, or the phenomenon of extra weakness on activity. And so this is why, purely on the basis of speculation, I've started a conditioning program and an exercise program.
I know there's a lot of interest, and folks feel they'd like to contribute additional comments and questions, but we really are going to be running short of time. We do have another presenter before the final panel, and again, if we're going to achieve our deadline of finishing by 11:30, I think we're going to have to move along. I'd like to present our next speaker, who is Dr. Larsen, who has come all the way from Denmark to be with us this morning. She is the medical director of the Anti-Polio Society in Denmark. and will share with us some of the experiences there observing in Denmark with respect to polio problems. Dr. Larson.
When I was asked to tell you about the polio situation in Denmark, I thought that I should have to tell you about Denmark because it's such a small country. But now I know all of you know Denmark, and most of you have been there. And I hope you will go back and visit my institute, because I have met so much kindness and hospitality here. In Denmark, we had our greatest polio epidemic in 1952 with nearly 6,000 cases. The vast majority of cases occurred in the capital, Copenhagen, whose population at that time was roughly 1 million. In 43% of the persons admitted to hospital, the paralysis were permanent. They received after treatment, most of them in the Polio Society's outpatient clinic, which, in addition to providing training, handled social problems and, for children, also educational problems. The Polio Society was founded in 1945. Its primary objectives were, and still are, to support the fight against polio and to treat and help polio victims. The outpatient clinic for physiotherapy was established the same year. At a very early stage, the society set for itself the goal to rehabilitate the largest possible number of polio victims, to help them to the greatest extent possible to become self-sufficient and resume an independent life in general and at work. After the large epidemic in 1952, the capacity of the clinic was expanded, and it has since provided treatment for a very large number of patients with paralysis. The number of treatments given to persons with severe motory handicaps, notably polio victims, is now 22,000 a year. The Society has made a national follow-up study which resulted in registration of 3,650 patients. In present estimates, there are about 8,000 polio victims in Denmark. The purpose of the follow-up, which took place during the period of 1976 to 1984, was to offer assistance to polio victims faced with either medical or social problems, to arrange for adaptations to their homes, and to assist in filling out and to recommend applications for aids, motorization, and social service. Where state-provided support is considered to be inadequate, the society is able to provide financial help. Following mass vaccination in the 1950s and 60s, there have been few cases of polio in Denmark, and all the fresh cases referred to the clinic for treatment occurred in immigrant children. We believed, therefore, that the number of polio patients requiring treatment would drop in step with a decline in their numbers. But that was not the case. The past 10 years have seen a rise in the number of persons referred to the clinic for help. We have compiled statistics of these recent influx, and it appears that the majority of the patients concerned are between ages 40 and 50, those who were children in 1952. The new patients we see often have social problems. They have difficulty in overcoming troubles which they were previously able to cope with at work or in private life. At examination, the patients complained of general weakening of muscle and pain in joints and muscle. objective examination reveal typical symptoms of overtaxing and degenerative changes in the form of arthrosis, meiosis, and tendinitis. These changes were often seen in extremities without paralysis, or in the spine and dorsal muscles, which have constantly been overtaxed because of scoliosis from shortening and paralyzing of one leg. In step with a progressive weakening of paralyzed muscles with age and wear and tear, the patients become increasingly immobile. They have mounting difficulty in walking, and many have to use a wheelchair. It is therefore of overriding importance to follow the performance of these patients very closely through conservative treatment once a week. These enable us to deal promptly with problems requiring special attention. Treatment required may be exercises aimed at preserving the level of self-sufficiency. Other requirements may be to relieve symptoms of overtaxing in muscle and joints, to provide the patients with appropriate supports, right type of sticks, right aids in the homes and at the workplace, and finally to assist in motorization. It is essential to make life easier for these patients and take care of their health if they are to have a fair chance of being able to continue to function at the level reached through previous treatment and own training. It was remarkable to see in several of these patients that the muscles were weaker than at previous examination. Over the years, we have seen so many cases of increasing weakness in the age group 40 to 50 that we realize that this is not a haphazard occurrence. But we ask ourselves, what is it that happens with age in the muscular system of polio patients? Is it age, or is it a post-polio phenomenon, or is it overtaxing? Being a clinician, I have not a paragonetic answer of this. However, as a clinician, I take great interest in the pathogenetic factors, also because they may give a clue as to how we can provide the best treatments. I'm glad I had the opportunity to participate in this symposium where these problems are discussed. I have listened attentively to the statements of experts on the pathogenesis of poliomyelitis. Finally, I have one question. What can we do for this patient? At least there's one thing I could do. I can go home to Denmark with the material from this symposium and try to convince the Danish social authorities that these patients suffering from the post-polio syndrome needs help and care. Thank you.
Are there some questions or comments for Dr. Larson?
Bruno, New York. I think we all share your concern in disseminating information and making physicians realize that these problems are real. I was struck by your comment about problems in social functioning and coping with life situations. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little more about that. Does it relate to what Dr. Owen suggested, that these individuals feel lonely, abandoned, that other people are not having the same experiences, or is it something additional, yeah, different?
You want me to tell some more about
the emotional, psychological, psychosocial problems?
Yes, I think all of you know this problem. I think it's the same problem you have here that in Denmark, don't you think that? The social problems.
In terms of disability in general, or in terms of coping with stress? Maybe I misunderstood.
Well, I don't think I understand your answer.
Okay, what I heard you say was that they were having problems in terms of social functioning,
yes.
in terms of coping with stress.
Yes.
I'm wondering if that is different. Is it associated with post-polio problems specifically, or just with disability, or having a new disability?
I don't think they are different from the other. I think it's the same problem.
It's the same problem?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Jenny Larry of St. Louis. I wanted to emphasize the psychological problems and the adaptations, and I think that they are a little different in the polios because they were treated as a group. They were conditioned to avoid an iron lung. It was bad. And so now it is not easy for them to go to a pulmonary physician and have to take night respiratory aid. They were conditioned to stay away from that wheelchair. That was the policeman. That was bad. There has to be a certain amount of reconditioning back. And I think this is best done through support groups, through being with other disabled people, and through reading about it. And this, we must approach this.
I agree.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment as a polio survivor. My own expectation after going through the initial illness, being weaned off a ventilator and getting out of a wheelchair after 6 months, was that I was left with residual paralysis and deficit of function, but I had an expectation that I had a reasonably stable chronic disability. And my expectation was that that would more or less persist with some gradual decline with advancing years. What I found difficult personally to adjust to, and this has been the experience of others I've talked to, is the unexpected nature of the new problems. And I think that does make it different from other diseases in which the course has been well described in the literature.
Yes, Maynard Ann Arbor. I wanted to keep this question of the exercise alive here and wondered if you could share any of your experience with, since it sounds like you are describing a lot of people with decreasing muscular strength, have you attempted strengthening programs for those weakened muscles, and what has the results been?
Yes, we have, but we haven't made research of it, but we are going to. Some of them are, most of them will be better if you train them and making exercise, but not as well as they were before. That's my experience.
David Bodian, Baltimore. When I presented the chart showing the course of acute poliomyelitis, you may remember that the curve showing virus infection of the spinal cord showed a sharp drop at about 3 or 4 days, and then extermination of virus in the spinal cord at the end of about a month. And the concept of this is that we have a convalescent period which is terminated, and the termination means that the disease is cured. Actually, it's the infection that's cured, and I think what Dr. Larson has shown beautifully is that we have to think again, rethink this thing in terms of chronicity rather than a convalescence which is terminated by a cure. There is no cure for any of us who have chronic conditions. We have to deal with the conditions that have developed in accord with what we see in the way of data supporting the need for this or that therapy.
That's what rehab is all about.
Thank you very much, Dr. Larson.
The session is now concluded.